So the title of the talk is How We Can Dance With Our Demons. And there's something very basic about the Dharma as a teaching, which has been thousands of years of development, which is that there is the truth of things frees us, not our wishes for what should be. And the truth of things is not always comfortable. And we've already talked about existential vulnerability, fragility of life. And I'm afraid I'm going to mention it again. But it's important if we want to understand why we need equanimity, what its role is for us. So basically, the truth of things is that we are not in control of life. Life is in control of us. And things happen. And we can't help wanting to fix them. We want to fix samsara. We want to fix things. But samsara is not fixable. And we still can't help it. We want to run our life. We want to be in charge of our life. There's a war going on, or has been going on, still going on. And we can't help taking it personally and wanting to stop it. And it's of course, there's pain, huge pain. But we also have to kind of allow truths that we don't have to take everything personally. We meet things that happen that are not in our control. And fundamentally, the existential vulnerability, the fragility of life is something we really have to keep meeting. We do meet all the time. But it's something that if we really allow it to talk to us, it shifts our way of looking at reality. The depressive side of it is the personal side. The Buddha said, always afraid is this mind of ours. It's afraid of threats that exist now, and it's afraid of threats of what might be. And in the last years, I've been working a lot with scientists who are studying the brain, including my brain. And the scientific model of consciousness is that consciousness is a system of processing reality so as to be safe. They call predictive processing what will be. So we need to know how to cross the road so we'll be safe. Consciousness, that's it. And it means that, you know, in a way, there's a sort of ground of anxiety in our existence, and it creates a lot of a lack of peace. And the Buddha said, there is in the end no safety anywhere except in awakening. You can only really find safety in awakening. And by awakening, we can also include equanimity. So equanimity is finding our ground. Is being steady in the middle of change, in the middle of a life we cannot control, in the middle of things that happen that make suffering. It's being balanced and ready for life in the middle of the whole thing. Seems impossible, huh? Of course, it is possible. And it's not about more defenses, because that keeps the difficulty, the predictive processing, the concern about life and what will be, what I have to do, what I have to make, what I have to fix. It keeps it going. The defenses are part of the problem. It's our survival mind, and we mentioned this before. Equanimity is things happen, but they don't knock us down. Things happen and we feel equanimity is not about not feeling pain and suffering. But it's feeling the pain and suffering, but it doesn't knock us down. And in a minute, I want to give a couple of examples of my own life the last year. So three images coming from sort of tradition. One image of equanimity is the basket. The basket is very light. It rolls in the wind. And when the wind stops, the basket is okay. So we can be like the basket. It rolls in the wind. Another image Odelia mentioned. The grasses, the cane that just blow in the wind, and when the or get trodden on, and then they come up again. That's similar. So a second group of images is the glass, to be transparent. Things come in, but they pass through us. They don't stick. And this is a really interesting place for our practice. That the stickiness of suffering makes us really suffer. That they come in and they work in us, difficult experiences. Again, the glass doesn't stop. The glass is not a wall that stops pain. But the glass allows pain to come in, but it doesn't destroy us. It passes through us. So I just want to give a few examples from my own life in Khalil in the last year, when for 1 year they've been endless. Booms, bangs, rockets, artillery. So the artillery is all around Khalil in the hills, or just all right next to us. Shooting Totachim, shooting to Lebanon, but then coming on us and past us and around us, the rockets, and then Yirutim coming up all around us as well. 1 year, from the 7th of October, more or less, it started. And I've... As an old-time practitioner and a love of equanimity, I was pretty equanimous nearly the whole year, I would say. But I'm still a human being. And there was a period in September, and I didn't move from there. When other families left with young children, I understand they went off abroad and so on. So my wife and I were going around feeding the cats and dogs that were left behind. We were there in Khalil. We didn't leave. So we were there right in the middle of things. We didn't want to run away. But in September, there was a period of a couple of weeks where, for some reason, or I don't know why, the equanimity went down. And I felt every boom and every bang and even a plane going over and even the sound of a gazelle motorbike in the road nearby. My whole nervous system was triggered. And I was looking at it, wow, I'm really triggered. And it was Bemet, the nervous system. I kind of was very aware of that. And I my dogs were triggered. They were doing the same. They barked and I was like this as well. And so I realized I needed to kind of increase the upgrade the equanimity. So I went into after the 2 weeks, I said, I can't keep going with this. I have to do something. And so I just sat a lot more every morning early in and into the space. And I know that the space is healing. And then it went. So I spent a lot more time sitting. And a lot of support from nature, connectedness, going up, getting up in the morning and going to the vegetable garden and planting seeds and growing the vegetables and meeting my chickens in the morning and the animals and the trees and the nature. A lot of support. And it really is in the environment, it's supporting equanimity. We have a bigger picture. And not so long ago, a friend came to visit and we were standing on the top of the hill, an amazing sunset. And we were enchanted. Sunset filled the whole sky. And then suddenly two Yirutim shot up from the Krayot in front of us and between us and the sunset. And then went bang. And we looked at each other and said, they cannot do a thing to the sunset. The sunset is huge and vast, and this is human stupidity and human small and lack of wisdom and lack of heart. These things, this. So, in the context of how I was in the year, a lot of support from the big picture every day. The big picture gives a lot of support. And an example of equanimity that I don't know if any of you were here from my course that I'm just teaching, but when there was actually a siren in Kleel, none of us have safe rooms, have shelters. You know, Kleel is a place with yurtim and tents and half-built houses. No, I mean, one or two have shelters, but that's almost none. So every time there is an alarm in Kleel itself, not so many, but it happened, I would just simply go under the table because I don't know what else to do. I don't have a shelter, so the table is good enough. I should have thought I'd do something just to kind of, I don't know what, so I can tell my kids I'm doing something or whatever. So I was in the middle of teaching on Zoom, the course I'm teaching now, it's finishing just now, on the factors of awakening. And I was in the middle of teaching, and there was the middle of a meditation, and then there was a siren. And I said, oh, just a moment, I've got to go under the table. I went, I went under the table. And then after a couple of minutes, I came out and carried on mid-sentence where I stopped. And at the end of the lesson, after half an hour, someone said to me, it's amazing that you're so cool. And I reflected myself, yes, that's a good model of equanimity. And I thought I would tell it to you. It's just a good example. I was under the table and then I came out and the same center, completely same. Nothing stuck. And I carried on the mid-sentence, calm, collected, and so on. So it's a personal story of how equanimity works. So equanimity isn't, by the way, oh, I shouldn't do, don't need to do anything. I went under the table, just, I don't know why. I mean, you can say it's ridiculous, but I did something. You go to the doctor, you take it. It's not equanimity. It's not instead of, so I must be equanimous about my health problems. And no, you, if you need to, you go to the doctor, but you go to the doctor with equanimity. So we are used to external protection, our safe room, our defenses against someone shouting at us, arguing with us, someone against us, or life that doesn't do what we want, or failure in life, or diseases, or loss, or other pains. We have defenses, external. Equanimity is defense that is invisible and internal. It's still protection, but it's protection inside, not protection of shirion and armor or defense. A defense external, someone argues with us and we shout back instantly, reaction. Internal is more invisible. So I want to give a few examples. We have a fight with somebody in the family, shouting at us, or our partners complaining, shouting, angry with us or whatever, or someone close to us or at work. And it makes us angry. What we feel is the reaction. We feel reactive. We feel automatic. We are not aware. We are just responding automatically to a challenge. And often with anger. And we feel that anger contracts us. We feel in the anger, it's automatic. Reactivity, defensiveness is automatic. It brings people into an automatic place and a minimal place. And they don't have the wisdom to know how to respond. So we can feel that, all of us. When we get angry and reactive, we feel the possibilities of dealing with the situation shut down. And you can feel it in conflict, in military conflict. The possibilities of something else shuts down. There's just reactivity. They get us, we have to get them, etc. Equanimity is in another place. The challenge from the other person that's shouting at us, the image of glass, it goes through. We feel it. We don't shut down. We feel that it's coming in. Someone shouting at us, it comes in. It can even a little bit, agitate the body. It's okay. It happens. But it doesn't undo our awareness. It doesn't shut us down into a very closed place of reactivity. The equanimity says, okay, I'm here. I feel the pain. I feel the challenge. I feel the insult, the elbow, whatever. But the equanimity means I'm looking at the situation. I can see the anger coming. I can see what's happening in me. I can see the other person. I'm still not knocked over by, you know, by the anger. The equanimity allows me then many, many other fresh ways of reacting, of responding, without getting locked in fight. The Buddha has a very nice text on how, what to deal with people that have different views and argue with you. And he basically said, if someone argues with you and they don't have very strong views and they don't have strong emotions, it's easy. You can talk. If they have strong views but not strong emotions, or strong emotions and not strong views, you can engage with them. But it's hard work. It's tiring. But if they have strong views and strong emotions, forget it. Don't argue with them, he said. But the bottom line is interesting. He said, but never underestimate the power of equanimity. It's an important line, one-liner. For this whole retreat, you can say this is a one-liner. Equanimity seems a bit invisible, but never, it has a power. It makes change. It makes things happen. It shifts the atmosphere. It shifts another person in a way that is not the same as conflict. It moves things. Our steadiness can help make others steady. Another example, tendency to measure. We all have it. Succeed, don't succeed. My meditation is going well, it's not going so well, but it gets much worse than that. More than once, I've had one-to-one meetings with people whose businesses have collapsed or who've started a project for 10 years and then it's all gone down. And then they get into deep depression and suicidal. It's a big thing. Success and failure, major, major influence in the mind. Again, it's about me and protection and my status and what I think about myself and how I measure myself. I used to be much more, before I really was into practicing, I was much more busy with success and failure for myself. And in England, I used to go into bookshops and see whether my books are there and then get disappointed when they weren't there. And today, the opposite of this self that wants success and is threatened by failure, the opposite of that, the equanimous place of that, is to offer ourselves to the world. We stay steady and we say, I can give this to the world. And then the world does with it what it wants. It's not in my hands. I'm not in control. It's not in my hands. This is a very important movement. It's really important because we're faced with it every day. It's not so easy, but it's really important. We give what we can to the world and we let go of results. That's the major sentence in the Bhagavad Gita, as maybe you know. It's the number one summary of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna told Arjuna, who was just getting ready for battle, facing his own family on the other side. And Krishna said, just more or less you're not in charge of life. Who do you think you are? Karma did it. Life did it. Life put you here and them there. There's nothing to do. It's an impossible situation that life made. You're not in charge. Just do what you need to do. Let go of results. Don't think. Just do what you need to do. I think in India they've gone a little bit too far with that. On all the Indian stations, they have this big sign, do your duty. Duty is an Indian word, duty. And, it's become quite a Western slogan as well. But it actually comes from there. I don't think do your duty is a good slogan. It's also been very, very abused by the Indians to support a horrendous caste system. And your duty, if you're an untouchable, is to stay an untouchable and be abused, because this is you let go of results. It's karma that does everything. So yeah, I think it's gone too far. But there's a deep truth in it as well. I remember waiting for a train in Varanasi station for 14 hours. Plenty of time to think of karma. There's another place that touches us, where we can look at the difference between equanimity and no equanimity. And it touches all of us, I think, in these days, which is we really want to change things in the world. We really want to make a difference. We want the world to be a kinder place. We want people to stop killing each other. We want less hardness in the political system and blindness. And so if we're not equanimous, we're going to keep going to demonstrations and be exhausted. We're going to be struggling against what seems to be an impossible system that doesn't pay attention to us. We're going to be frustrated again and again. We don't make change. I mean, how many years have been here, demonstrations in Balfour and so on, and what's the result? So it's very easy to say, I can't make a change. I give up, and so on. So we want things to be changed in a certain way, and we invest in it, and we want to succeed, and if it doesn't happen, we get angry, frustrated, feel helpless. But the equanimous place is something else. We give what we can. We go out in the world. We offer what we can. We stay calm and we stay steady. We inspire other people to be calm and steady. We are not into the same mindset of anger, violence, etc. We offer a different way. And then we leave it to the world to take the results. We can do what we can, and that way we still have energy. We can do it for years because we're not exhausted. We're not burnt out. We're not frustrated and helpless. And we just give what we can because that's the nature of things. I was thinking of the peace walks. We've done many years of peace walks. And there was something about the peace walks which was equanimous, which was peaceful, which helped us as we were doing it to feel aware, Palestinians, Israelis, right wing, left wing, walking quietly. We were fed by them. We were more peaceful and we brought peace. Whatever happened after that? So it may seem like a bit kind of helpless if we don't have a model of what we want to happen. And I think we can have a model of what we want to happen, and that will help us sort of go in a certain direction. But we also have to be deeply relaxed that we're not in control. We do what we can. I really look at great leaders in the world who have that quality of equanimity. Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, Dalai Lama, etc., who gave so much to the world, but they had a steadiness and a quietness. And that gave them, in a way, much more power than if they were hysterical, angry, and fighting everybody. So we need that sense of a bigger picture and steadiness. Recently, I was talking with one of my granddaughters about global warming, and she said, "I'm no longer worried about it." I said, "Why?" And she said, "Because life knows what to do. Life is more intelligent than people are. Life will survive. Life will do what it needs to do. I trust life." Actually, in the 80s, 70s, and 60s, actually 70s, 80s, when I was very active also in ecology and so on, the first James Lovelock, who introduced the whole thing of global warming and so on, he brought it up in his writings. He was a scientist, but he said the same. The world is alive. Gaia, it's his word. Gaia is a goddess of the earth, and it's aware. And he said, the world is alive. The world is alive. Gaia is like a goddess, and it will know what to do in the end. So what is common about all these three examples that I've given? The example of success and failure, the example of making change in the world, the example of if we're stuck with a challenge, someone fighting us, someone arguing with us. What's the equanimity? What's common in all those examples? Also my example in CLIL. The first thing is that we are coming from a place that is a bigger mind than being totally into good for me, bad for me. What's good, what's not good. What's pleasant, what's unpleasant. We're coming from a bigger mind. We're coming from a mind that is able to step back and hold pleasant and unpleasant. Not that they're not, pleasant is still pleasant and unpleasant is still unpleasant. That's not up to us. We can feel pain and we can feel joy. But there's something that's bigger than both. And that's what we're learning here. That's what we're learning in every retreat, in every meditation practice. It's about Vedana, is the traditional language for that, feeling life. Not investing it all our energy in what needs to happen, what's better, what's I know, our predictive processing of the consciousness, which is totally in it. That's good for me, not good for me. And they're annoying me, they're hurting me, they're not, they're this. And with just less preference. Being less busy with preferences. Adieu for yacht. So my favorite quote about this is from William Blake. So I just want to quote it. 17th century mystic, one of my great inspirations. And he writes, "It is right, it should be so. Man was made for joy and woe. Woe is the ancient word for, you could say, joy and oi. So woe is difficulty and pain. So man was made for joy and oi. Man was made for joy and woe. And when this we rightly know, through the world we safely go. It's very beautiful. We go safely when we know that we can hold pain and joy, and we know them. We are not under them. So that's one thing that is always there in the examples I gave, but of course in your own life. A second thing that's common in all the three examples is the sense of more space, more inner space, more possibilities, less contracted. They hurt me, react. That's contracted. Also, we're learning here to be aware, to be present, to have more inner space, and then we are not knocked over so easily and by everything that happens. It's an image that's used in CBT. A teaspoon of salt in a cup of water, and the water gets very salty. A teaspoon of salt in a lake, and it's no taste of salt at all. If our consciousness is small, a cup, a teaspoon of salt, some mental problem, some issue, some difficult emotion, difficult experience, it all goes salty. But if the consciousness is bigger, then the salt disappears. So it's a more spacious inner world, more aware. And again, it's what we're doing here. We're being more aware. Aware of the trees, aware of the body, aware of the breath, aware of the food we eat, aware of each other, aware of it may be difficult, maybe we didn't sleep at night, maybe there's issues, but still, over the direction is awareness. Rather than shutting down, we're opening up. So that space is, you can describe it as being less centered on me, less me-centered, more centered on awareness, more with awareness and less me in the middle of it all. And a third aspect is just simply less busyness with strategies, with ways of doing things better, with what should be, with success and failure, and less busyness with all kinds of ways in which we try and kind of make the impossible more comfortable. We can't control life, so we're busy with all kinds of strategies to try and deal with it. Denial, classic one. Unbelievable the way there's so much denial around climate change. And you think, how amazing that nobody's, like a lot of people are aware of it, but some of the big, you know, people that are really big, powerful people, just in total denial. So denial is a problem. Blame, it's their fault. Yeah. Blame is another one. Switching off is another one. Apathy. And here is where indifference, adishut, comes in, and avoidance, or switching off, or just watching TV, or watching media and telephones, all of that so as not to see and not to be connected to the truth of things as they arise. And so there's, in equanimity, we don't have these strategies. But I have to say that sometimes avoidance and indifference, adishut, are needed. It's not absolute. Sometimes we, something is too strong for us. We need to say, not now, thank you. And a story I've told, I think many times, probably every year in the equanimity retreat, and I don't know how many equanimity retreats I've taught, but it just stayed with me. Of an old guy, I used to teach old people in the college near Klil, Yahel, which was the Vatikim, the old people of the kibbutzim. And they were really so into it, and they were so into practicing, and they so loved meditation, just to be quiet and to come back to themselves, and they were all having quite a difficult life. But one guy said, I really, really appreciate everything that you're doing. It's changed my life. But there's one place of difficulty and suffering that is out of this area. And he rolled up his sleeve and he had a number from the Holocaust, the Shoah. And all I could say is, you're very wise. We can't deal with all the pain in one go. And there's a wisdom of saying, this one, no. This is too difficult right now. Leave that. I'm not going to try and meet that one as well. It's all too much. So there's many ways that Dharma can help, but it has to be done with wisdom. So sometimes, yes, we do need to have our protection, to have our walls. But slowly, slowly, we can undo them. Bit by bit, in a natural way, as our awareness grows, we can find ourselves less needing boundaries or protection, external protection. So I want to summarize ways in which we can develop. Again, we've said these before, but I just want to kind of put them in a kind of a list, so that hopefully you'll listen to this talk when you get home from a site of Tovana, when you want to know, how do I practice equanimity? I totally forgot. So much, they said so many things, these teachers. I don't remember. What do I do now? So look up the talk and there'll be a list. First is, we do need to develop inner qualities through just being aware and knowing, for example, taking time to stop, taking time to be quiet, finding ways to calm ourselves, walk by the sea in Tel Aviv because I'm agitated, finding love from the world, from the people close to us, ways in which we develop qualities of calm and joy of life. How it's so good that, you know, my wife and I were working in the vegetable garden every day, never mind rockets. It just gave us a perspective, joy of life as a ground. And you can be joyful in the middle of pain and suffering. It is fine. You don't have to feel guilty. It's what we deserve to. We are alive. Life is joy. Life is dance. So remembering that joy of life, not trying to, I must be smiling all the time, But just remembering that the joy of life is there. So that's some of the qualities. Ethics is another one. To be aware of what we do in the world, to the world, our relationship to the world. The ethics and how we are in the world is a very important basis for our inner life. It's not just something that we have to kind of deal with quickly. It really is a basis to be, to have a pure life. Affects everything we do. Affects the way we look at reality. So an ethical life, which can be many things. It can be helping others. It can be dana, giving ourselves to others in many different ways. It can be connecting to others. It can be offering ourselves. It can good heart, being with our good heart. And part of that also building different qualities of our being is to win back attention. Because our attention is all the time being stolen by mobile phones, media, lots of input from lots of people that are influencing us. We're all the time. Lots of advertisements, lots of political slogans, lots of interference. And we need to win back our attention again to ourselves and to what's important. So that's another aspect. So all that is in the realm of what qualities, how we live. Okay, and that's part of it. A second world of practice is to be aware of the big picture. This is not abstract. Everything I said about karma, for example, is not abstract. It's really something we can touch all the time in our real daily experience. This moment is built from so many influences. I'm not in control. This action I'm taking, I'm influenced by all kinds of things. This action is coming from karma. It's coming from all the causes and conditions that made this moment happen. A little bit to allow the bigness of things. We're practicing it here in our connection. We're feeling in a bigger space. We feel belonging to the earth and the trees. And each other, and our mind, and the world. We're living in a bigger space. So awakening or meditation keeps opening our consciousness. Like I said, the lake and not the cup of water. And as I was saying in the walking meditation, today, one of the ways that the Buddha described meditation practice that helped specifically equanimity in this context is meditation on the elements. And he said, let your meditation be like the earth, because the earth is huge and can accept everything. It's endless, it's vast. So our meditation can be like the earth, or like the air, or like the sky, or like my story of the sunset. Keep being reminded, also in our meditation practice, of something bigger, of a bigger space, of something beyond our limited personal perspective. And the third aspect is the more classical side of the Vipassana practice. Our mindfulness practice, to see clearly where we find difficulty, where we find to see our dramas and our stories and our feelings clearly, to allow them, to meet them, to meet them as they come and go. And the key is to be able to be the witness of our stories, the witness of our dramas, the witness of our challenges, the witnesses of our pains and our pleasures, to be a witness. And this being a witness is non-identification. Ihizdahut is non-identifying. And that's a key. That's a key to the practice. You can say it's anatta or non-self. It's about not being totally inside all the stuff coming up, our stories. And so there's less space, there's more space around things. There's more space around what happens to us. There's more space around our difficulties, our challenges, our issues. And that's a gradual process. And it helps to make things a little bit less personal. And then things don't stick so much. They don't stick. Things, difficulties that happen, don't stick. They'll be there, but they don't work inside us because we're practicing a sense of allowing stuff to come and go and allowing a bigger space, being less me, the subject, the sufferer, the victim. It's just, there's just not a big voice anymore. And that's a process that takes time, but it's a process that just in all the meditation goes in that direction. It all goes in that direction. Anicca, anatta. Things come and go. We have to allow them. We have to meet them. We have to give them their name, to have to see them, give them their real name, to notice, to recognize our inner world and our inner experience, to be ready to do that. And then to step back and say, yes, I see you. Hello, goodbye. Okay, thank you. So I'll take a couple of minutes.